Tonight we'll be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, the first part of the chapter, verse 1 to 14, and the title is Suffer All Things, Lest We Should Hinder. But before we get to that, we'll sing our opening hymn, which is hymn 360. As I said, Brother Mark Bailey is going to be speaking to us on the first half of 1 Corinthians 9, to the title, Suffer All Things, Lest We Should Hinder. And we're going to depart from the usual format of having a reading now. Mark is going to summarise 1 Corinthians 8, first of all, and then after that, he'll call Brother Ben Phyllis forward to do the reading, to lead us in reading 1 Corinthians 9, and then it'll be on to the main part of his talk. So I hand over the evening to Brother Mark, and we look forward to hearing about 1 Corinthians 9, verse 1 to 14.
I apologise for the jacket. I grabbed the wrong one on the way out. So anyway, hopefully the rest of the night will go smoothly. Okay, so basically, as Dan said, what I want to do first tonight is basically work out what we did last time with Uncle David. We had an excellent class based on 1 Corinthians chapter 8. I thought tonight, rather than just launch into 1 Corinthians chapter 9, that what we'd do is together we'd just recap and try to work out and remember what the argument was in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And then once we've worked that argument, have Brother Ben read chapter 9 and then look at chapter 9 and try to work out, well, what's the flow of thought? So in order to do that, I thought what we'd do is first, who can remember what the subject was last week? It was 1 Corinthians chapter 8, but what was the main theme that Uncle David was referring to? For whom Christ died. Yep. Yeah, it's on. Is it on there? Oh, yeah.
Meat's offered to idols.
Okay, so, sorry about that. So, meat's offered to idols. Offered to idols. Hope everyone can read that. Okay. So that was the theme, and then Uncle David went through those verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, and basically we worked out there were two parties. What were the two parties that we established last week? There were two groups of people.
Weak and strong.
Weak and strong. Okay. So we have the strong, and we have the weak. And then we looked through and worked out, well, what were the characteristics of these strong brethren and what were the characteristics of these weak brethren? And that's what we looked at in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Now, we looked at the relation of weak and strong in regards to meats offered to idols. How can we bring that forward in today's terms? Instead of meat offered to idols and this idea of strong and weak, what are some of the issues that we would be looking at today as far as strong and weak? Because we really want to make this class relevant for tonight, relevant to us. So what would some of the issues be that we could be looking at today that we may have? Are we all strong brethren, or are we all weak? Can anyone think of any issues today? Yep.
The atonement,
as far as strong brethren, weak brethren, yep. Can anyone else think of any other issues?
Legalism versus faith.
Sorry?
Legalism versus faith.
Legalism?
Yeah.
You obviously know I can't spell. ISM versus faith. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yep.
On the wrong side.
Oh, that's okay. Yep. What are some everyday issues that we may face in life?
Money.
What about things like movies? Some of us may not have any problem with stepping down to Marion here and popping along to one of the movies. Yep, some of us may have a real problem with that. Sorry? Oh, idolatry. I thought it said something about your dog, my dog or something. Idolatry, yep. Idolatry, yep. What are some of the other issues? About things like pubs, drink.
Gambling.
Yep, gambling. Sorry? Sorry? Yep. Things like contests?
Fashion.
Competitions? Fashion? Okay. So now we've got some of the issues in relation to weak and strong. And a lot of us may be on either part with some of those. So let's assume this is the strong side here and this is the weak side. I only said that because I looked at Ben and said strong and weak over here. So that's what we'll do. So in relation to that, as we work down through 1 Corinthians chapter 8, here we have the strong brethren, and on this side we have the weak brethren. So what's the flow of thought that we considered last time? Well, basically, as far as the strong were concerned, we saw in chapter 8 that there was this issue of knowledge. And in particular, there were two things. One is that these strong brethren on this side were saying, well, there's only one God. And as a result of believing that there was only one God, they were saying that no idol has any real existence. And so that was the argument of those on this side. And as a result, they had no problem with eating in idols' temples. They had no problem perhaps walking into some of the pubs or drinking or seeing no problem with going down on a Saturday morning, night or whatever and just watching a movie. That was the attitude of the strong because they realised that there was still only one God. And it didn't matter what they did, that wouldn't affect them. However, in relation to the weak, it was the conscience that they had a problem with. And to them, they thought that they needed to abstain from things offered to idols. And so they had a problem with eating in idols' temples. They had a problem with going to the movies, with going to the local pub or drink or whatever it was, because they had a weak conscience. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, the Apostle Paul puts forward this scenario. He says, suppose you with your knowledge of God should be observed eating meat in an idol's temple, or as far as the strong here, say you just happen to be walking into a local cinema, are you not encouraging the man with a delicate conscience to do the same? So you've walked in and a weak brother just happens to be walking past and sees you go in. And so that scenario he puts forward. He said, well, what's the problem? Well, he says, surely you would not want your superior knowledge to bring spiritual disaster to a weaker brother for whom Christ died. And so he says, this is the issue. Should we be guided by our superior knowledge or love? By saying, well, we can go along to a movie, as the strong side says here, because it doesn't affect us. We don't have an issue with that at all. Whereas the weaker brother who observes that on this side says, well, actually, if it's okay with them to do it, why can't I do the same? And sometimes we get issues like that in the ecclesias today where it does affect one or the other. See, we may not have an issue with Ben going to a movie once a week, but What about if Uncle John organises a group of us to go down one night? As being a leader in the ecclesia, we may think, well, if it's okay for him to do it, not saying anything against Ben, well then, why can't I do it? Why can't I organise a group to go down? And so we're starting to get all these issues about strong and weak in the ecclesia at Corinth at this time. And so as Paul was dealing with those brethren and sisters in Corinth who had these issues, Paul says, well, the only way I can settle this argument between the strong and weak is this. He says to them, this is my position. He says, in theory, I agree with the principles of the strong. But he says, in practice, if there's any possibility of meat injuring my brother, I will have none of it. I fear I might do him harm. And so that was the Apostle Paul's position. He agreed totally with the strong, but at the same token, if he thought there was something that in his life that he did that was going to affect another brother, Paul said, well, forget it. I'm not going to do it at all. And so that was his argument at this time. And so in summary, we see that whatever a man may know, he still has a lot to learn. And while knowledge may make a man look big, it is only love that can make him grow to his full stature. And hopefully that's provided us with a summary of 1 Corinthians chapter 8. We can see what Paul's position is on the subject. And now when we come to chapter 9, we're going to find what Paul then goes on with. So we'll ask our brother Ben to come forward now and read for us 1 Corinthians chapter 9.
Reading together from 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are not ye my work in the Lord? If I be not an apostle unto others, yet doubtless I am to you, for the seal of mine apostleship are ye in the Lord. Mine answer to them that do examine me is this. Have we not power to eat and to drink? Have we not power to lead about a sister, a wife, as well as other apostles, and as the brethren of the Lord and Cephas? Or I only am Barnabas? Have not we power to forbear working? Who goeth a warfare any time at his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not of the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth the flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, Thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for oxen? Or saith it he altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that ploweth should plough in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we shall reap your carnal things? If others be partakers of this power over you, are not we rather? Nevertheless, we have not used this power, but suffer all things, lest we should hinder the gospel of Christ. Do ye not know that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple, and they which wait at the altar are partakers with the altar? Even so hath the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. But I have used none of these things, neither have I written these things, that it should be so done unto me, for it were better for me to die that any man should make my glorying void. For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of. For necessity is laid upon me, yea, woe is unto me, if I preach not the gospel. For if I do this thing willingly, I have a reward. But if against my will, a dispensation of the gospel is committed unto me. What is my reward then? Verily that, when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not my power in the gospel. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews, to them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. If therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air. But I keep under my body, and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway.
Thanks, Brother Ben. And so now what Paul goes on with in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 is his argument that he's now developing. So what's the flow of thought, the connection between 1 Corinthians 8 and 1 Corinthians 9? Did anyone pick it up as our brother Ben read those verses for us? Yep, and that's exactly right. So what he's doing there is, as our brother Dan has said, is that he's now going to show that, well, like the Corinthians, like these strong brethren, I have rights as well. But Paul says, well, whilst he has knowledge, that it's only love that can make him grow to his full stature. And so Paul knows that, you know, if what he does is going to offend others, then he ceases to do so. And now he's showing in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and chapter 9, he's going on to show, as an example of love in action, he's going to look at the example of himself. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he's going to look at the history of Israel. And so what then is this flow of thought in 1 Corinthians chapter 9? Well, putting it down at the very basic level, this is what Paul's going on to say. He's going to argue in verses 1 to 14 that like as these strong brethren, Paul too had rights. But in verses 15 to 18, he says that whilst I have these rights, he refuses to exercise them. Instead, he chooses to serve all men, and this requires self-control. And very simply, that's what 1 Corinthians 9 is all about. It's about Paul having rights just like the Corinthians did. But Paul refuses to exercise them because he chooses to serve all men, which requires self-control. And so Paul previously has been dealing with people who had asserted their rights to the detriment of others. And Paul's now telling the Corinthians that this practice must stop. And we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 9... that there's at least 19 to 20 rhetorical questions that Paul asks. And so you can imagine Paul standing there before the Corinthians and saying to them, when we read 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 1, am I not free? In the original is actually what comes first. So Paul's there before the Corinthians and he says, well, am I not free? Am I not free? of which implies, well, of course you're free. And then Paul goes on to say, well, am I not an apostle? And of course, those in the audience will think, well, yes, Paul, you are an apostle. But is the order that we have there important? What Paul was saying is, he's saying that, like the Corinthians, I too have rights. And he says, I have the same rights as the apostle. And Paul is foregoing not only the rights that all believers have, but he's also saying here that any rights which I have as an apostle, well, I'm foregoing those as well. And as an apostle, Paul had rights, but as we'll find out, the Corinthians doubted whether Paul was actually an apostle at all. Despite everything that Paul had done, they still doubted that Paul was an apostle. And now we find that not only has Paul have to argue why that whilst he has rights, he gives them all up for the sake of others, Paul now has to argue why he's an apostle. And we see that come out now in the rest of verse 1 and 2. And Paul uses two arguments to prove that he was an apostle. He says, well, have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? And the second argument he uses is, are not ye my work in the Lord? And so Paul says to the Corinthians, well, if you're doubting whether or not I'm an apostle, well, have I not seen Jesus Christ with my own eyes? And they said, well, come back to Acts chapter 1, and what does it say about an apostle? And when we come to Acts chapter 1, where we read what the qualifications of an apostle are, we read in Acts chapter 1 and verse 22 that if you were to be an apostle, then from the beginning of the baptism of John unto that same day that he was taken up from us, must one be ordained to be a witness with us of his resurrection? And so what they're saying is, well, if you're going to be an apostle, you have to be a witness of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, had Paul witnessed the resurrection of Jesus Christ? I'm asking that as a question. Had Paul witnessed the resurrection of Jesus Christ, if that's what it means to be an apostle?
He saw the resurrected Christ.
Okay, and where is that? Sorry?
Conversion.
Yep, at his conversion in Acts chapter 9, verses 4 to 5, verse 17, and in Acts 26 and verse 15. Paul saw Christ on the road to Damascus. And we know from Paul's own words in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 8, that Paul tells the Corinthians that he was actually the last person to see the resurrected Jesus Christ. And so from that point of view, Paul can safely argue that, well, he meets the qualifications of an apostle because he had seen the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But then he goes on to say, well, if that's not proof enough, are not ye my work in the Lord? He says, well, aren't you, Corinthians, the product or the proof that I am an apostle? He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 6 that you, Corinthians, I was the one that planted. He said, I was the one, in 1 Corinthians 4 verse 15, who had begotten you through the gospel. You saw all the miracles and the wonders that I did. It was you that saw all the words I preached about Jesus Christ. Now we have an ecclesia established here in Corinth. And so he says, well, isn't that proof enough that I am an apostle? And so he goes on to say in verse 2, if I be not an apostle unto others, he says, yet doubtless I am an apostle unto you. For the seal of mine apostleship are ye in the Lord. And so he says there that, you know, there may be others out there that doubt my apostleship, but surely you Corinthians having witnessed the work that I've done amongst you, must realise that I am an apostle. You shouldn't even question that. And they should be the last ones that were doing it. And so he says there, he says, for you are my seal of my apostleship. And the word seal there means the signet. By implication, the stamp impressed as a mark of genuineness. And so, reading from another translation, he says, you Corinthians are the seal or certificate or living evidence of my apostleship. He says, you confirm or authenticate that I am a true apostle. And we know that a seal is something that someone stamps to show it belongs to someone. And in the case of the Corinthians here, Paul says that they were a stamp or a living proof that Paul was an authentic apostle. And so Paul was, as we can see from these verses, he was an apostle. He was out there actively preaching the gospel. And his work was effective because God's power was working by him. And we know that Paul gave himself totally to the work of the truth at Corinth. And despite all that, Paul says he refused to claim the rights of an apostle. And so he says in verse 3, my answer to them that do examine me is this. And here in verse 3, is it relating to the things in verses 1 to 2? Or is it relating the things that are to follow? When we look at the word answer, we see that it really means an interrogation. It means to be examined or accused. And in Acts chapter 22 and verse 1 and 25 verse 16, we find it's used when Christ appears before the leaders at that time. And the word examine means to give an account or a legal plea of oneself. And again in Acts chapter 4 verse 9 and 24 verse 8 and 28 verse 18, all occasions where it's used is as a defence of something. It's their legal expressions. So what Paul is saying here, well, I'm on trial. He says, my apostleship is under attack. And how do we know this? Come across to 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 7. He says, have I committed an offence in abasing myself that ye might be exalted? Because I have preached to you the gospel of God freely. You know, because Paul refused to accept the payment for the work that he had done, it was this very thing that placed doubts in the mind of the Corinthians that he was an actual apostle at all. All the other leaders had accepted the material blessings that the Corinthians had bestowed upon them. But Paul said, no, I won't accept your hospitality. I can make my own way. And Paul had very valid reasons why he did that. And you can see then what the Corinthians were thinking as a result. They were saying, well, if Paul and Barnabas are real apostles, well, we would support them, but since they're not supported and no one else is, well, we suppose they aren't really apostles at all. And so Paul knew that he had already been examined by the Corinthians. We know from our earlier chapters in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 3, Paul says, it matters very little to me that you or any human court should cross-examine me at this point. This wasn't the first time that Paul had been placed on trial. And so in verses 1 and 2, we find that Paul here is giving an answer to those who doubted his apostleship. Paul felt as though he was on trial and answering the Corinthians about his apostleship. And so now from verse 4 we read that he goes on to say, have we not power to eat and drink? Have we not power to lead about a sister, a wife, as well as other apostles, and as the brethren of the Lord and Cephas? Or are only or I only in Barnabas, have not we power to forbear working? And so in the earlier verses, we go from I, and now in verses 3 to 6, we have this expression, we. Who were the we that was included with Paul? Well, obviously from verse 6, we can see that it was Barnabas. Barnabas was another one that, like Paul, that didn't accept the hospitality of brethren and sisters. And we'll look at the reason why for that in a minute. But we see here, Paul says, have we not the power to eat and drink? And so having in verses 1 to 3, lay to rest this idea and prove the fact that he was an apostle, he now picks up the argument of 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 13, about whether he eats meat or not, whether he is offending his brethren. He says, look, I refuse to do that so I don't offend. And so we see here in verse 4, have we not power to eat and to drink? And the word power simply means authority or liberty to do anything that we like. And we know this word reoccurs numerous times through 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Occurs again in verse 5, in verse 6, twice in verse 12 and in verse 18. And also in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 9. And so as an apostle, what rights did Paul and Barnabas actually have? What rights did apostle has? And so Paul now goes on and continues looking at, well, what rights could he claim as an apostle? In verse 4 we see that as an apostle he had the right to eat and drink. In verse 5, he had the right to take along a believing wife and also be supported, both him and his wife. And also in verse 6, they had the right to refrain from working and to be supported by others. And so, what's this right of, have we the power to eat and drink? Well, obviously, what that's referring to is the maintenance that he could receive at the ecclesia's expense. Let's come over to 3rd of John and verses 5 and 8. In 3rd of John and verses 5 to 8, here we read some of the maintenance or support or the hospitality that the Corinthians could show towards apostles. And we would do exactly the same today. In 3rd of John, reading from verse 5, beloved, thou doest faithfully whatever thou doest to the brethren and to the strangers, which have borne witness of thy love before the ecclesia, whom if thou bring forward on their journey, after a godly sort thou shalt do well, because that for his name's sake they went forth, taking nothing to the Gentiles. We therefore ought to receive such, that we might be fellow helpers to the truth. And so some of the things that the apostles could receive is things like accommodation, obviously the food and the drink that went with that, and all the things that we would do today if we had someone come here and say do a special effort, we would put them up as something that we would do to help them out. So we'll do exactly the same today. So coming back in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he says, well, not only do we have the right to eat and drink, he goes on to say in verse 5 that have we not power to lead about a sister, a wife, as well as other apostles and as the brethren of the Lord and Cephas? So what Paul is saying here is that most of the other apostles and their wives receive support from the ecclesias they laboured to. He says you just have to look at the examples of some of the other apostles that were about. Apollos, for example. And he says, well, why are you thinking about Apollos? What about the Lord's brethren? What about the half-brothers of Jesus? Think about their circumstances, the fact that they have wives and the support you show towards them. And he says, what about Peter as well? You know, when Peter comes with his wife, don't you provide support for them as well? And then he goes along in verse 6 and says, well, or is it only I and Barnabas who must work for a living? And so what we want to consider for a moment is why does Paul single out Barnabas? Who was Barnabas? Well, let's come back to Acts chapter 4 and see if this gives us a bit of insight as to why Paul includes Barnabas. In Acts chapter 4, and reading from verse 36, we're introduced to this man Barnabas, where we read, and Joseph, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, which has been interpreted the son of consolation, a Levite, and of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it, and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. So why does Paul include Barnabas? Well, there are two views put forward. The first is that Barnabas had sold everything that he had and had to work for a living. Barnabas had given everything up for the sake of the truth. And as a result, as he went about preaching to brethren like the Corinthians, in order to survive, he had to work, and he chose to do so. The other view is that because Barnabas was a wealthy landowner, that he didn't take advantage of the hospitality. He was in a position where he could pay for his own way. And so they're the two of the views put forward as to why Paul includes Barnabas. He may have a third. And so we see here that Paul was the odd man out because he travelled on his own without the practical support of a wife to look after him. But imagine what sort of savings that was to the Corinthians. You know, all these other brethren, well, the Corinthians had to pay for the expenses of them and their wives. Yet, as far as Paul concerned, he was only half the price, if you want to put it in crude terms. There was only one of Paul. And the Corinthians only had to pay half his expenses compared to the other apostles, compared to the Lord's brother and Peter. But Paul says, look, I'm not even asking for that either. Paul had many rights, but he claimed none at this time. And Paul and Barnabas were unique in this regard because they chose to work and to support themselves, so that no one could accuse them of preaching for money as a motive. And so Paul worked to ensure that he wasn't a burden on any ecclesia that he visited. And we have the example of when he went to Ephesus in Acts chapter 20, verses 33 and 34, and the example of his visit to Thessalonica in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 7 to 9. And so Paul's words here are linking his right to eat and drink, are linking his right to lead about a wife, which possibly could strongly imply one of the reasons why Paul chose to remain single. Because if Paul did not exercise his right to be provided with his meals and accommodation, then maybe he wasn't in a position to support a wife. That's just something to think about. And so now Paul is going on in verses 7 to 14. In verses 7 to 14, he's now arguing or putting forward the idea of why Paul has the right to be supported by the Corinthians or to the brethren that he ministers to. The first reason that he gives is in verse 7, and it relates to common practice. He says in verse 7, who goeth a warfare at a time at his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not of the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth the flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? So just think for a moment as we just read those words in verse 7, what is it that's connecting all these ideas together? what's the common theme in verse 7 that Paul is trying to put forward to the Corinthians at this time? What's connecting it all together? Does anyone know? Fruits of your labours. Even more succinct than that, what Paul is saying, they were all fed from their occupation. That's the point Paul's making here. That these people, whether they were a soldier, whether they were, what do you call a vineyard person? A vine dresser? Or a shepherd, were all fed from their occupation. The word charges there in verse 7, Bullinger says, means that whatever is brought to be eaten with bread, provisions, especially supplies for an army. It's not referring to wages as such, but provisions or something that can be eaten. A vine dresser planteth a vine that he may eateth the fruit, and the shepherd can either feed from the flock or feed the milk or get the milk to drink. And therefore, it should not seem strange to Corinthians that Paul has the right to be supported by the people he ministers to. Just like these people have the right to get the fruit of their labours, or in this case, to be fed from their occupation, Paul, doing the work of preaching to the Corinthians, says, well, based on common practice, I have the right to be supported by you as well. And it's interesting, as an aside, it's interesting that those different occupations that Paul mentions there in verse 7, that at some point in his life, Paul occupied all those three roles. As a soldier in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 3, as a vine dresser in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6 to 8, and as a shepherd, as laid out for us in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2 and 4. No one could deny those things of Paul. And so he says, based on common practice, I also should be supported by you. That was reason number one. Reason number two, he says in verse 8 to 10, say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of an ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for the oxen? Or saith he it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that ploweth should plow in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of this hope. And so Paul was now going through, and as reason number two is looking at a scriptural precinct. And so we read here that in verse 8 that Paul is arguing that, well, hang on, if you think that example I just used of common practice of, you know, what happens in everyday life, you know, that's just a common example. Well, he says, well, now I'm going to give you an example that's endorsed by the law of Moses. And so Paul now supports his first reason by going back to the law of Moses. And this really enhances his position on the matter. And we see here that Paul is quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 25. So when we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 25, we see here that Paul says, quoting from verse 4, simply says, thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out the corn. So why can no man muzzle an ox? Well, in the NIV it says, is it about oxen that God is concerned? Well, we'd have to say yes. God does care for oxen, as Proverbs 12 verse 10 tells us. However, There's a greater lesson here that is really needed to be considered. And so we read, do you suppose God's concerned with the oxen? Or is it a reference clearly to ourselves, is what he's putting forward to the Corinthians? We find that God wants to establish a principle. It says, you shall not muzzle a threshing ox. It's a threshing ox. It was labouring. It was a working ox. It wasn't resting. And so what the principle is that while the ox works, it's allowed to eat. The word thresheth there is the same as treadeth out the corn in verse 9. And so we read, that's in Corinthians, what Paul is arguing here, that the ox had done its work. And therefore, what he's saying to the Corinthians, that those that work hard in their work deserve to be rewarded for their efforts. The ox, in this case, worked hard to grind the corn and therefore had earned the right to eat some of it. So the principle that the Apostle Paul was trying to get across to the Corinthians was that anyone who labours in the truth has a right to be supported by the people they're labouring to. And it's interesting to note that, you know, there'd probably be not only one ox, could have been two, three or four, that here we have a group of oxen working together, labouring together, achieving. And both get the reward of being able to eat as they work. Working together as a team. And that's certainly something for us to think about as we labour in the truth. As Philippians says, are we working together for the sake of the truth? If we come over to Luke... we won't go there yet. So what we see here is that it's this idea of the labourer is worthy of his hire. So providing he does the work, he can eat. And that's the idea of no man muzzling his ox. And what Paul goes on to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 is that, you know, just quoting this law, this portion from the law, he says, he's saying, of course, this example refers to us in the sense that, as he goes on to say, in the sense that the ploughman should plough and the thresher thresh in the hope of getting some of the produce. And it goes on about this idea of cooperation, this idea of working together. And if we come back to John chapter 4, verse 36, we see here this principle put forward of working together. In John chapter 4, where we read in verse 36, and he that reapeth receiveth wages, and gathereth fruit unto life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. Cooperation. And what an amazing example or principle that is to us as we work together in the truth. Now, as we reflect upon how much we labour for the things of the truth, we need to think and reflect upon whether we're working as individuals or whether we're working collectively as a team. Does it really matter whether we're a sower or a reaper? Who decides whether we're a sower or a reaper? Does it really matter? Because we find what Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 is that whatever position that we find in our labours in the truth, whether great or small, both are entitled to an equal share. It would be cruel to starve those who were providing and preparing the food and to do so would take away all their hope. And so as Paul goes through these rhetorical questions that he asks, as well as these additional questions, each question which he's asked, who does a certain kind of work without receiving pay or produce, as he's speaking this to Corinthians, they're all saying, well, no one. You can see that from his argument. He says, well, does the soldier who goes out, should he supply his own supplies? Does the vineyard who does all this work, does he not to get to eat of his fruit? Or the shepherd, does he not get to partake of the milk? The case of the ox, does he not get to partake of the corn? And those that plough as well and thresh, don't they get partake of it? And so Paul is slowly building up this argument. We're saying, well, if that's the case in common practice, he's really giving practices that were social practice or the conventional social practice of the time. In other words, the principle was a common practice throughout the society that Paul was living in. And thereby, Paul, by right, ought to also receive that same support from his labours in the truth by the Corinthians. If we just come across to 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 18, where again this verse is quoted about the muzzling of the ox, we read, "Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn, and the labourer is worthy of his reward." Paul says it's common practice in society. We've seen that it's supported by us, it's a scriptural principle. And as a result, the labourer is worthy of his reward. Paul, now in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 11, now brings up a third reason. It's to do with intrinsic justice. And we read in verse 11, following on the same idea that we've picked up in the first reasoning, as he's building a solid argument, we read in verse 11, "If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we shall reap your carnal things?" Paul's saying that, you know, we labour here providing you with spiritual food. He says, is it too much to expect from you a material harvest? Would you be greatly perturbed if we reap some of your material things as we labour amongst you? Paul says if he labours in this greater spiritual work amongst the brethren in Corinth at this time, then surely he will do so in the hope of benefiting in a lesser material work for the Corinthians. And Paul says, look, and he reminds them here in this thing that you're already doing this. You're already practicing this by providing for other brethren who come and labour before you. In fact, we find that this was a principle that came out of the Jerusalem conference. If we come back to Romans chapter 5 and verse 15, verse 27, we see that outlined for us there. That this point was the one that was made at the Jerusalem conference in verse 27. For he says, "For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, then their duty is also to minister unto them in carnal things." He says, look, if they're going there and preaching the things of the truth to you, then you need to provide the appropriate accommodation and tend to their needs, so they don't have to worry about those things and can be there to strengthen and encourage you in the work of the truth. And we know in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 6 that Paul says to the Corinthians, look, I've planted, Apollos has watered, and God gave the increase. Paul had sown this spiritual seed in the Corinthian ecclesia, and all they had to do was return some carnal seed back to Paul. But Paul was saying, look, I don't even want that. And so what happens today? Those who devote their time and energy to the work of the truth, are they adequately rewarded? What sort of hospitality are we showing, perhaps not to those that are labouring from the platform work, but labouring in anything in the ecclesia? How are we supporting their work in that efforts? Are we providing hospitality to each other? Are we encouraging them, providing them with positive feedback and saying, that's a great work, fantastic? What happens today? Are they adequately rewarded for their work that they have done? And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul goes on with this argument in verse 12. He says, well, if you allow others these rights, have not we a stronger claim? But I have availed myself of no such right. On the contrary, I put up with all that comes my way rather than offer any hindrance to the gospel of Christ. That's the New English Bible version of 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 12. And so Paul tells them, look, you're doing this to others. If you allow others these rights, then hasn't Paul, as the one who had planted the seed in the ecclesia, doesn't he have a stronger claim as one of these that got the ecclesia up and going in the first place? Shouldn't he by right be provided with this support as these others that have just come along since and the Corinthians are attending to their needs? Don't I have a stronger claim, Paul says. And we see evidence of this in 2 Chronicles chapter 11 and verse 5. Look at the type of brethren that the Corinthians were providing this support to. We read in verse 5, for suppose I was not a whit behind the very chiefest apostles. So Paul wasn't classified as one of these chiefest apostles. And in verses 18 to 19 of 2 Corinthians chapter 11 we read, seeing that many glory after the flesh, I will glory also. For ye suffer fools gladly, seeing ye yourselves as wide. And so Paul's saying here that, you know, these are the sort of characteristics of the people that you're providing support to. Don't I have a stronger claim? But as we've already seen, they refused to support Paul because he didn't have, because he refused it from them. And they questioned whether Paul was actually an apostle at all. But did these brethren question the apostleship of these other brethren that they were supporting? Were these Corinthians' brethren, were they consistent in how they were determining who they were supporting and who they weren't? Or were they biased in some way? Because Paul was saying that he spread the gospel in Corinth, and therefore he had the greater right to receive help and support from these brethren and sisters. And Paul strongly points out, however, that though that may be the case, he again refuses that right. Why? Because Paul says he has a mightier thing in mind. We see there he doesn't want to hinder the work of the gospel. If we go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we're now really coming to the crux of Paul's argument here before the Corinthians. He says, look, all these examples that we've looked at already, whether it was the soldier, whether it was the vine dresser,
Whether it was the shepherd, the ox, whether it was the sower, they all laboured and expected support. They who, and Paul says here, that I too have these rights, but he says that I'm not going to avail myself of them. He says, I'm not going to do that. Why? Because he might hinder the gospel of Christ. The word hinder there, that we read there in verse 12, means a cutting into. And it's the idea say, in army terms, of breaking up the road to prevent an army's advance. Or in Australia, we would use the same idea when we create the fire breaks out, where we clear a large section to stop the fire jumping from or for spreading. It's breaking up the road to prevent an army's advance. And Paul was saying here that he refused these rites because he was avoiding doing anything that might prevent a clear road for the gospel to advance. Paul was saying he didn't care whether he received the support or not. What mattered most to Paul was the work of the gospel, and Paul didn't want to be a hindrance. We see there in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 12 that also in there he says, nevertheless, we have not used this power, but suffereth all things. Suffereth all things is the word endure, which we know means to roof over, or figuratively to cover with silent, or endure patiently. The word endure is used in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 7. The same word used there where he says, concerning love, that love beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. That's the same word. And Paul's saying that this kind of love endures all things. It's saying that Paul was a man who was ready to endure anything for the gospel. And Paul wasn't interested in his rights when faced with that proposition. And so Paul denies himself this right. He gives it up for the sake of the gospel. And this is the whole point of Paul's arguments. Should not the Corinthians deny their right to eat meat sacrificed to idols for the same reasons? And so Paul goes on in verse 13 to put another reason forward. Do ye not know that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple? And they which wait at the altar are partakers with the altar. And so we have two classes of groups participating in this verse. Those that minister in verse 13 are the Levites. And Deuteronomy chapter 18 verse 6 to 8 supports that. Whereas the class that wait at the altar are the priests, as described in Leviticus 6 and verses 16 to 17. And so here we have two different groups who are participating together, even though their work was different. Even the Levites and priests, Paul says, received according to their labour. And Paul here makes it plain that it is right for the spiritual work of God's ministers to be repaid with the material support of those that they're preaching to. Another solid argument to go with those that he's already produced. Yet again, Paul is going to refuse. And then in verse 14, Paul sort of comes with his ultimate example of the command of Christ. And we read in verse 14, even so hath the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. So he says, in the same way that Christ gave instructions to those who preached the truth, that they should earn their living by the gospel. And everyone recognised the authority of Christ. Now, these words of Christ don't appear to have been recorded in the record. However, in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 10, we read, "For a worker is worthy of his food." And in Luke 10, verse 7, we read very similar. And also in verse 8, "Whatever city you enter, thou shalt receive you, eat such things that are set before you." And Paul was saying that from the words of Christ, even he said to those that went out and preached the truth, that they should accept hospitality. We know from lots of examples that Christ was supported in his work. And likewise, he expects that his disciples, that his apostles also be supported in their preaching work. And so it was that the ecclesia is taught by the apostles to take care of those that preach the word. And so that's where we're going to leave it tonight. And so we can see that this argument is being developed by Paul in chapter 9. As we saw from the end of chapter 8, verse 13, concerning this example of whether they should eat meat or refrain, Paul says, "Well, if meat make my brother to offend, I will eat no flesh while the word standeth, lest I make my brother to offend." And so Paul says, "I too have rights, but I'm going to give them up for the sake of my brethren." And so in verses 1 to 14, Paul neatly goes through not only proving first that he's an apostle, but he says, I have all these rights just like you do, Corinthians, but I also have these rights as an apostle as well, but I'm going to give them all up for the sake of the truth. And we're going to find that a little more next time. So looking at Paul's rights again in summary, he says that in everyday life, soldiers, farmers and shepherds all receive a reward for their toil. He says that the law of Moses even rewarded the corn-treading oxen. He goes on to say that ordinary gratitude should cause converts to support materially those who supplied them spiritual blessings. He goes on to say that the apostles were more than spiritual teachers. They were their fathers in Christ. And he goes on to say in point 5 that in the temple arrangements, priests were provided with the necessities of daily life. And Jesus commanded that a worker is worthy of this food. Paul presents this argument that, look, Corinthians, I have all these rights that I can claim, but I'm going to refuse all those for the sake of the truth. As we read in those words, that Paul says that he was going to deny himself the right, he was going to endure all things and give it all up for the sake of the truth. And as we think about those things, of this argument of strong and weak, I really liked this phrase that Uncle David used last time, of this spiritual firewall. And I thought that as we contemplate these ideas of strong or weak, as we think about Paul's argument and where we fit in the scheme of things, whether we're strong or weak, perhaps some of these ideas here, which are come out of a Christadelphia magazine about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, these ideas are a good thing to think about as we go about our daily life. And what it's doing for us is setting up a spiritual firewall for us to help us protect our brethren and sisters, that we can come to the conclusion of Paul that, yes, we have rights, but we're going to give them all up for the sake of our brethren and sisters. And so when we find ourselves in these positions, putting up this spiritual firewall will help us. So some of the things to think about are this. as we go about to do some sort of activity. Can I offer thanks beforehand and thus commit what I'm doing to God? Will the activity I'm about to do, will that be edifying? Will what I'm about to do cause my brother or sister to stumble? Can I do it to the glory of God? Can I share it with my brethren and sisters as an act of fellowship? Or would I do it if the Lord Jesus was with me? And if we can, in our daily life, develop this spiritual firewall, then when we will be like Paul and be able to say that I will forsake these things, I will endure all things to ensure that the work of the gospel is not hindered. Thanks.
On the class's behalf, I'd like to thank Brother Mark for his words to us. There's ample time for questions, so we'll open the class up now for questions or comments.
Fuck.